Good afternoon. It's Friday, March 10th, Discovering Victory Podcast. This is our opportunity to share with you messages that have been preached from the pulpit here at America's Keswick. We're going back to last summer. This would be for week three. Dr. Ed Hardesty, who now serves on the staff at Lancaster Bible College, shared a wonderful message, a series of messages during the week. Great communicator, great friend of this ministry. Let's listen to part one of Dr. Ed Hardesty's message.
So much to say, so little time. Share a little bit about myself and the fact that I feel like I'm at home. There's a lot of familiar faces out there, a lot of brothers and sisters. You jog my memory, brother, as you begin to talk about unity. Hinematovu manayim shevet achim gam yachat. Tehillim 133. How good and how pleasant it is when brothers dwell together in unity. Marvelous, marvelous way to begin. I got home from Vietnam and I was a train wreck. Some of you don't even remember that there was a war going on some 150,000 years ago now. Got married, been writing to a gal for 10 months. We fell in love by mail and I met her for the first time in September of 1969. We just celebrated our 52nd wedding anniversary. Yeah. So, three kids, eight grandchildren, and what do they call me? Well, they used to call me at Cairn what my grandchildren call me, Saba. That's Hebrew for grandpa. Okay. We were in Israel with a bunch of kids on a tour, and one of the guides heard them calling me Saba, and he said, you know, that's awfully disrespectful. He's your professor. He's Dr. So-and-so. You know, I said, yeah. Some of the pitiful PhDs I've met since I got my PhD is astounding. You know, they're not working people. They don't produce much. They just argue a lot. Bottom line of all this is the kids turned to the guide and said, no. That's an earned title. He's our Saba. He's not just a prof. He's not a teacher. He's our grandpa. He's the dad away from home. That's an earned title. That didn't come easy. When I got home from NAM, I was a mess. You wouldn't have known it. My specialty was weapons and munitions. If it went bang, anything from thermonuclears to small sidearms and grenades, that was my job. I was in charge of weapons for an entire rescue squadron. Our job was to go get them when they got shot down. That was the published job. The unpublished job was to extract deeply inserted teams that had gotten in trouble, couldn't make it out to their LZ. So we fought our way in, we grabbed them, and we tried to bring them out. That had a unique opportunity in front of me on a regular basis. You internalize that, you don't worry about it, you don't think about it, you're very busy at the time. But it all comes back to visit you, often in the middle of the night, often in relationships. You began to learn what triggers such things. There's a great name for it now. They didn't have a name then. It's called PTSD. I'm a poster boy for the VA when it comes to PTSD. They say I'm badly damaged. I should be sitting somewhere in a corner, stuffing something up my nose or pouring it down my throat or sticking it in a vein. The shrink at Lebanon asked me one time, you need to explain to us how come you're functional. Why is your marriage still around? How come your kids are succeeding? You're holding the job. We don't understand it. You should be sucking on your thumb in a fetal position in the corner somewhere where you've been, the stuff you've done. I said, that's easy, lady. Jesus healed my heart. She says, I can't write that down. I said, I don't care what you write down. You ask me the question, that's the answer. Jesus healed my heart. 13 years after I got home. Gordon separately used to let me crash in his office when I was a student at PCB. He didn't understand what was going on. I didn't understand what was going on. I just fell apart. He let me fall apart, and he kept saying, Jesus will heal your heart. From there to Dallas Seminary. Dallas Seminary, I met a guy named Stan Toussaint, Dr. Stan Toussaint. Awesome brother, became a very good friend. His legs were messed up from polio as a kid, And at the time when I went to Dallas, I had destroyed my right ankle up at snow camp at Word of Life. And I'm hobbling around on crutches, and I met Stan Toussaint in the hall, an academic too. He was on crutches, I was on crutches, and he goes off the elevator and smacks me up the side of the crutch and says, "Get out of my way, you cripple." I said, "Dude, we are brothers, okay? What are you calling me, cripple? You know, look at you." That's when I knew I had to find Stan, and I had to take whatever he taught. When I went through PCB, I was like a sponge. It was the first time I'd heard a lot of these things. I was the guy in the front row with my hand up in the air every 15 seconds. "Prof, what about, what about, because I'm 10, 12 years older than everybody else in the class. I'm looking for very different things than they are." And I had, in my heart, wasted a lot of time, and I'm still processing a lot of garbage from Southeast Asia. In the meantime, I'm filling notebooks, and I'm yelling, and I'm asking questions, and this, that, and the other. Elmer Johnson said to me one time, "Ed, you don't know enough for me to waste the answer on you at this point. Keep studying, keep in the book, come back to me after we finish this particular section, and we'll spend some time on that question you asked. But you don't know enough yet for me to waste the answer on you." I thought that was pretty crude. "I'm paying your salary, Jack, you know." He was right. All through PCB, I was just sucking it in. And then on to Dallas Seminary, now I have three children, and I crammed their four-year program into five. There wasn't any sugar daddy paying the bills. You know, you have two and three part-time jobs. My schedule was weird. I studied from about 3 in the morning to breakfast. The kids got up. They fed them. They went wherever they were going, some to school, some not to school. You know, I went to class and came home and crashed until they got home. I had supper, went to work, whatever the part-time job was that took up the day. At the end of that period, it's midnight, I'm home. I crash for a little bit, get up 3 o'clock, start studying again, right on through till breakfast. There's about 10 or 15 years of my life that's kind of a blur. But in the midst of that, there was this shining star that made sense of what Gordon Sepperly had told me so many times. "Jesus will heal your heart. When's he going to do that? How's he going to do that? What's that look like? When am I going to experience it? Because I'm falling apart here." Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 to 3. That's all we're going to look at through my ministry here before you the rest of this week. Three verses. Stan Toussaint opened those verses to me. Well, the Spirit of God opened my heart to what Stan Toussaint was saying that he had already placed on his heart, which was exactly what I needed to see the preeminence of Jesus Christ and what that means on a daily basis. Really quite amazing when I stop and think about all the different bits and pieces of all this. See if I can figure out how to do this. That's not it. There we go. Stan had a way of putting the cookies on the bottom shelf. That's what Howard Hendricks used to tell us to do. One of the things about Hebrews is that it's a difficult book. It's an amazing book, but it's a difficult book. It's the highest level of Greek in syntax and vocabulary in the entire New Testament. It reaches a whole different level than the rest of the books in the New Testament. We don't know who the author was. We don't know who it was sent to. All we know is it's phenomenal, and it is the major presentation of the priesthood of Jesus Christ. Dealt with here far in excess of any place else you find it in Scripture. It picks up on the Levitical priesthood in the Old Testament and brings it to a whole new level realized under the New Covenant. Who wrote the book? That's the question. This book came into the canon and quickly was forgotten who wrote it. The brothers and sisters back then knew, but we don't know. So there's been 1,000 different people deciding they know, and they've made suggestions. One said Luke. Clement of Alexandria said that. There's only one problem with that. Luke wrote Luke and Acts, but he's probably not Jewish. Very Jewish. Now, Luke was a wannabe. He just wasn't a Jew. Another said Silas. Well, that was in the 1800s in Europe. They decided it was Silas. Now, I don't want to lose you in the weeds here. This is the minutia. Understand, I'm a geek. I love this stuff. Okay? but you may get lost in the weeds along the way. So pick up your ball and jacks and hold it off on the side. We're getting to a point with all this, okay? What else is going on? Silas is said to have written it because there's certain similarities between Hebrews and 1 Peter. And Peter's amanuensis, the guy that wrote the stuff down as Peter dictated it, was Silas. There's only one problem. Silas didn't determine the content of 1 Peter. He just wrote down what he was told. Barnabas is suggested by Tertullian, one of the early church fathers. That was in the early second century. But it seems to suggest that Barnabas got this idea from somewhere else. He's writing it like in the third person, all the things that were said about him. There's only one problem. He's from Cyprus. Nobody in Cyprus thinks that Barnabas wrote it. It's your hometown boy. Aren't you going to parade your hometown boy around? Aren't you going to be in his corner? Aren't you going to champion him? Nobody in Cyprus wants it. So long, Barnabas. Apollos, there's a good man. Apollos in the New Testament, the great man from North Africa. Martin Luther decides he's the guy. There's only one problem. The character and the style of the message fit what we know about Apollos, but no one in the early church had a notion that it was Apollos. See, there needs to be some kind of continuity here. Why do you need to know the author? Because you want to know something about their person, their character, their ethics, their morality, whether or not they spent time with Jesus, who they were in the early church, what kind of position they held, were they honored, were they venerated, etc. Well, we don't know who the author was. There's a lot of candidates, but the biggest, most leading candidate is the Apostle Paul. If Paul wrote Hebrews, then he wrote over half the New Testament. If he didn't write Hebrews, then he wrote just under half the New Testament. And there's a couple reasons, some of them pretty shallow. I mean, they're limp, okay? But they're quoted in the commentaries. The writer is associated with Timothy. That's very clear in Hebrews chapter 13. And Paul and Hebrews both emphasize the work of Christ. Oh, really? What New Testament book doesn't? You know, Paul and Hebrews both emphasize gifts and power. Yeah, and there's Ephesians and 1 Peter and Romans and 1 Corinthians. They do too. What does that prove? Paul and Hebrews emphasize the new covenant. That's true, but Paul really doesn't get to the nub of the new covenant and how it's applied unless, of course, he wrote Hebrews. Habakkuk 2:4 is quoted three times in the New Testament. Paul uses it twice, and it's used here in Hebrews. Is that Paul? Did he do it? We don't know. So since the first two are Pauline, the third one might be too, but here's the most clutch argument for Pauline authorship. Both Paul and Hebrews emphasize faith. That's actually in the commentaries. Somebody was that lame to put that as a reason Paul wrote it. That's ridiculous. Where isn't faith emphasized? Paul and Hebrews both use Israel as a major example. Okay, now you're talking with something substantive. But what's it amount to? Oh, those aren't the only candidates. This gets crazy. When the brothers and sisters really want to know something, they dig deep and they get strange. Have you noticed that? They really begin to get strange. Objections to Paul? Well, he places the author in Hebrews, whoever it was, places himself outside the circle of those who knew the apostles. That's in chapter 2. The author never mentions his own name. Paul always does, unless it's here. The style of writing is more classical than Paul's, unless the subject matter drove him to write more effectively. The major stress on the priesthood of Christ is found in Hebrews, not in Pauline literature. Unless, of course, Paul wrote Hebrews, and then there's his stress. It comes to the forefront. You have to love this list. I had to include this just because I find it humorous, all right? Here's some of the other suggestions, and the last one is absolute a clincher. Clement, Philip, Priscilla, Epaphras, Mary together with John and Luke, and an unknown monk in a monastery in Jerusalem disguising himself as Paul. That's actually in a commentary in terms of evidence for who wrote this. What's the conclusion? We don't know. We don't know who the author is. For those of you that have an obsessive compulsive complex, who have to have everything tied up nice and neat and in the pigeonholes, I had a student like that, several over the years, but one in particular. And she would come in and she'd put her notebook down and she'd lay out pencils and a pen like this, and she'd put an eraser up here and she'd take her name badge off and she'd set it there. And everything had to have symmetry and it was just right on there. And I'd just walk by her desk and go, and she'd freak out. And she'd straight, Pop, don't do that, Pop. Okay, I won't. And I'd do it again. It was fun. It was just absolute fun. Some people have to have all the answers. Stan Toussaint gave us the proper answer. He was quoting a friend of his that told him who the real author was from the Bronx in New York. And the guy said, we don't know who the author was. Forget about it. Does it matter? I would suggest to you, the content of this book is so amazing, so deep, so incredibly Christ-centered, that arguments over authorship pale to insignificance. The book in all its glory and its revelation just rises way above any contest of that sort. Oh, the contest goes on, though. It gets crazy. Where did it go? It went to the Lycus Valley. No, it went to Corinth. No, it was written for Rome. No, it was mentioned. Rome was there because Italy is mentioned in the book itself in chapter 13. Israel, Cyrene. What's the conclusion? We don't know where it was sent. What do we do know about it? The culture it was sent to was specifically Jewish. It's the Jewish culture in diaspora. It's the people that were kicked out of the land. It's the ones that showed up at Passover when the church began, and all sorts of things accrued in that regard. They all went home and they began to spread the word about Jesus is the true Messiah. Jesus is the King. Jesus is risen from the dead. And the Spirit of God has invaded our lives, and we know that we know that we know that these things are true. Does it matter where it was? Not at all. What time was it written? Real late in the first century? No. How do we know that? Because Clement of Rome quotes it in his writings in 95 AD. In 70 AD, the temple is destroyed, but there's not a single reference to the destruction of the temple or the ending of a viable priesthood in the book of Hebrews. It's not there. It's still occurring. It's still functioning. The priesthood is still in place, and the temple worship system is still intact. So what do we know? We know that Paul dies in 67 AD. Paul is around when this is written. He owed 2 Timothy, but Timothy's not associated with Paul anymore. He's on his own. So best guess, somewhere between 68 and 69, the book of Hebrews is written. Not by Paul. Who's it written by? We don't know. Where's it sent? Where's the destination for the letter? To a specific Christian Hebrew background group of people who are steeped in the Greek language, not so much Hebrew. How do we know that? Because they're Hellenistic Jews. What do we mean by that? They're not in the hometown. They're not in Jerusalem. They're not in Israel at all. All the quotations from the Old Testament in the book of Hebrews are from the Greek translation from Hebrew to Greek of the Old Testament. The Septuagint is called. The LXX is the way it's read in scholarly journals. But what's important about this? Their spiritual condition is people that had failed to go on to maturity. Now, Stan Toussaint spent 3 weeks on these three verses. We're going to do it in 1 week. He'd roll over and hurt me if you knew I was doing that. What's going on? Jewish believers, brand new in Jesus, haven't gone on to maturity. They're untrained. They're untaught. They're just, barely in the kingdom. And nobody's coming to them. They haven't had the opportunity to steep and grow in Scripture. All they had was the Old Testament. And many of the New Testament writings were in place, but had not yet been greatly disseminated on a wide level. So what do they have? They have what they're familiar with. And when pressure comes, and when bad times come, and hard times come, what happens to people? They default to their comfort zone. They want to go back to how they were raised, what felt best, where they succeeded, where they got accolades from people and got reinforcement along the way. And that's what they were trying to do. But it points out, the writer to this points out in chapter 5, why do you guys still need teachers after all this time? You should be the teachers by now. Why have you not gone onto maturity? What don't you understand about sanctification, about living the Jesus life, about watching not only entry-level understandings become embedded in your heart, but grow that and become the man or the woman that God created you to be, to learn to walk with Him, to trust Him, to understand Him? What's the purpose of the book then? To encourage Christians to grow to maturity. Stan took 3 weeks to get to that line. I was so ready to hear that. As I had all the bits and pieces in place, but they weren't flying in formation. And I had all the information, but I was not yet ready for prime time. And at this particular point, I was really struggling. Really struggling. Not only with my past and everything that came with it, but finding my way with the Lord. See, Gordon Sepperly was right. Jesus will heal your heart. How's He do that? What's He do? What's it look like? When's it going to happen to me? Don't go back to the comfort zone. Don't go back to your Mosaic Judaism. That's over. There's a new name written down in glory, and it's yours and mine. There's new life. I want that. I want to experience that. Don't go back to apostasy. Don't fake it. Don't play like it. Don't try and assimilate it or function in the midst of it if it's not real to you. Got to be real. How many of you have ever read The Velveteen Rabbit? Know what I'm talking about? The children's book? It's a little stuffed animal, a little stuffed rabbit, little plush rabbit. And there's magic in the nursery when the kids and the adults aren't around, you see. That's the thesis of the book. And the animals that are stuffed animals and toys, they talk to each other, and they talk about the adults and they talk about the kids. And the rabbit is the favorite toy of this little boy. And he wants to know how he can become real, because he wants to be able to love the little boy back. The little boy loves him so much. So he asks the most venerable, most ancient, most wise of all the toys, the oldest one there. It's an old skin rocking horse, a stuffed animal. He says to the skin horse, how does one become real? Skin horse says, oh, it's not a switch you flip or something of that nature. When someone loves you, especially a child, when they really, really love you, then you become real. But understand something. By the time you're real, most of your fur has been loved off. They've yanked strands out of your tail to sting beads. You're all loose in the joints. Your eyes are falling out of your head. You're missing parts along the way. But it's okay. Because once you're real, you can't be ugly, except to those who don't understand. So, Dr. Toussaint, how do I become real? While you're on your way, you have the information. What's the application? Here's the plan. The writer to the Hebrews gives us three verses. If you have those three verses, you have the entire book. And what I hope to do in the rest of this week is to infect you with a love for this book, so much so that you'll want to pursue it yourself. That's my intention, to aggravate you and tantalize you and hook you into this with those first three verses, so that you must go to the rest of the book and understand how this fleshes out and what it looks like at the other end. Because if you have the first three verses, you have the rest of the book. It's just a matter of plugging in the revelation as it comes to you into the properties that are available to you in those first three verses. He is greater than the angels. He starts out there. It's the superiority of Christ that's demonstrated in this book. It's not that He came to destroy. It's not that He came to dismantle, to put something down. He's greater than. Therefore, this fades to insignificance. It doesn't go away. It's not bad. It's not inappropriate. It's just less than. And when you see Jesus in light of who He is, what He's done, how He functions, and what He means to you, religion dies. and relationship takes its place.
All right, James, what's happening? Weekend's right around the corner.
It's here. It's basically here. Today is National Pack Your Lunch Day. Do you do that very often?
No. Do you?
No. I live here. Well, we both live here.
Yeah, you know what?
So I guess we could
growing
run home.
Growing up, we used to do that all the time. You packed your lunch for school.
Got your lunchbox.
Little lunchbox.
Yeah, your little.
My dad always took his
thermos.
We had a staff member who's retired, but he came every day with his lunchbox.
Yeah.
So, yeah, John Holland, good guy.
That's very cool.
All right, so what's happening?
So we had a great week, Girl Talk, Men's Fellowship Night. Awesome, really thankful. Next week is our March Beyond Youth Night. So if you are watching, if you're listening, and you have any affiliation with your youth at your church or your family, please take advantage of this opportunity to tell them about it, to bring them out for an evening of worship, of hearing the word from Connor Ruskowski of New Life Church, and then spending time together, really in the activity center.
Okay.
Playing games with Anna and I.
Okay, good.
So looking
fun.
Forward to that.
Yep.
And then speaking of games and fun, we have our Spring Forward weekend starting on March 31st. That's a Friday, and it runs through the entirety of the weekend through April 2nd. We're going to have the Easter choir concert taking place.
Living Hope.
Living Hope is the title of it. That's on Saturday night, and we'll have an Easter egg hunt taking place. We'll have the Good Egg Contest taking place, and we'll have a Sunday morning service that weekend as well.
So for more information about what's happening here in America's Keswick, call 1-800-453-7942 or visit our website, www.americaskeswick.org. If the podcasts are a blessing in your life, I want to encourage you to give a gift today. That helps us with the cost of all the events and all the things that we do to serve people here at America's Keswick. You can give a gift by calling 1-800-453-7942, or you can give a gift online. www.americaskeswick.org. Donate now. Have a great weekend. I trust that you will join us on Monday, Worship Live at 1:30. God bless.